responsibility to tell the truth. That's huge. In 1997, it comes out of a court case of Monsanto versus the bovine growth hormone people, and they ruled that the story about telling people about this was biased because it damaged the company. It damaged the profits of the company. And they ruled that lies by omission are okay. They don't have to tell us if something changed. And it also said that Pelosi proposed a law to stop this, and it was defeated. But, you know, they're all into hating Pelosi. I wonder what other good things she's done that they're not telling us about. So I think that I would like to read a poem that I wrote last week. I'll stop with these notes for a little bit and go back to them in a while. This poem, it's very intense. It's a very intense political poem. And I would say it's some sort of economic, of a automatic writing, because it shot off my arm so fast. It's called Atrocities. They turned love into sex, young people into criminals, brotherhood into gender issues, the golden rule into Satan, and music and something that comes out of your rear. They turned our homes and ourselves into merchandise, our loved ones into psycho killers and narcissists, quote unquote. Corporations turned everything holy into something to fear, every comfort into something to buy that poisons us. There's not one breath of air that's not infused with cadmium, strontium, and aluminum. There's not one drop of water on this earth that's not been touched, not one poor creature that's not been harmed by their perverted, sinful ways. The Spirit of God is happier in gay bars and in homeless camps than in the halls of power where religious bullies use the written holy, quote-unquote, word, the holy word to enslave mankind. Those in the churches voting for atrocities should go home now and read the Bill of Rights and Jesus' words. There's not one person we can trust, no home that we can hope to keep. Instead of telling people not to kill all living things, religious leaders tell them they will burn in hell if they use birth control. The kind and loving Father Jesus preached is turned into a bigger and more cruel tyrant than the kings, emperors, and other thugs that rule the earth. Let's pray the tie-dyed dream of peace has an effect on what turns out to be the biggest monster ever seen. There's no comparison between bloody weapons of old and what is used to slow us down today. Oppressors learned that cameras, jails, and mind control are more effective in subduing us than clubs and chains. The torture chambers of the ancients are still with us, now joined by debt and liability, and psychiatric drugs that make men mad. It all makes money, and that's why we're told it can't be changed. Fiduciary responsibility, quote unquote, is an excuse to rob each one of us of basic needs, so that a few can collect mansions and the earth's water and land. The misery that will be unleashed if corporations have their way, and I said that right, corporations are killing everything, they're all about death. I have no sympathy for them. I have lots of sympathy for the people involved in them, though many of them didn't choose this stuff. They really have no choice. They're going to lose their job, their home, and everything else, just like we do if we don't obey. Okay, the misery that will be unleashed if corporations have their way is beyond imagining. The hell that right-wing preachers push, which Jesus didn't teach, is already here in the weird ways we live and is not made by God. Prelates and kings and the Apostle Paul added a ton of garbage to the words of love and hope that Jesus gave. So that's it. I wrote it in about a half an hour, and I didn't change a word. It was really exciting, and I like it a lot. I think it's cool. I hope you like it. It takes in a lot. It includes quite a lot. So where's my water? I got to drink water after that. Okay, I'm still here. Yes, I'm trying to make this show about something, like to really inform people about things that are going on. And I know a lot of this is my opinions, but I think they're backed with a lot of research also. And I'm just doing the best I can to show my vision, my heart song, the best way that I can. And I hope it's working out. Nobody's calling to complain yet, which makes me wonder how many people are listening. But it's okay. It's okay, because these things are all recorded, and, you know, we're going to use them, you know, on the YouTube channel that the man puts my stuff on. And he's called Mark Mercado, and he's reading Peace Drums by Joan Rivard. I think you can find it online. I should try it just to see what happens. I did look at it a couple times. Anyway, he's amazing. Well, I talked about the fairness doctrine, and now I'm going to talk about how he deregulated advertising. Does it say here, marketplace should dictate what's successful? I'm not sure exactly what he did to deregulate advertising, except it does say that he made Mark Fowler the head of the Federal Communications Commission, and he believed that the marketplace should dictate what is successful as far as business. In 1981 was doomsday for educational shows for children. And they started to broadcast cartoons based on toys. The broadcaster would share profits with the toy sales. If they had a show that was about a toy, and then the toy sold, they would get some, the broadcaster would get some of the money. And they started to go with action figures, action vehicles, Transformers, G.I. Joe, My Little Pony. All these things were, you know, made for profit toys and children's shows. And the advertising corporations started to discover the pester power of children, they called it. That they want the children to whine and cry to get toys. And they also started product placement in shows. Actually, I think that was before the deregulation. That was what was happening before they tried to regulate. I'm not sure. I'm a little mixed up here. I don't have all the information. But the advertising and toy selling people, that was against the rules before deregulation. But was that? Did they change that in 1968 or when Reagan came? I don't know. It's pretty close. It's the same people, the same business entities, large clubs of business entities with millions of lobbyists and stuff like that. They deregulated it. So it didn't have that before. There was a certain number of shows that had to be educational, and you couldn't sell a toy on the show. Well, they changed all that, and they got children to whine and cry, and they're making our children do that all the time too. Anytime they want anything, they're ruining the children, them and the psychiatrist telling us not to ever discipline them in any way, not even yell at them. You know, people don't have control over their own kids, and that's another topic. So when they tried to put a stop to this, a romper room, they stopped product placement in romper room. But then, okay, I don't know too much about that. But the deregulation Action for Children's Television Ads Act in 1968 was supposed to stop the ads and the violence. Then the Reagan guys defeated it. They changed it afterwards, and because these shows had begun to push junk food, toys, cereals, and drinks, and they had lots of violence, and so the Reagan guys made that okay. They make Mark Fowler the head of the Federal Communications Commission, saying that the marketplace should dictate what is successful. I already said this to you, but that's okay. I can say it again. 1981, doomsday for educational shows. And they started to have lots of cartoons based on toys where the broadcaster shares profit with the toy sales. And I told you all the ones, My Little Pony. I can tell you something about My Little Pony that I noticed. I don't know who else noticed it, but I did. Well, the little ponies were very sexualized, just the way they looked, their expressions, the eyelashes on them. And then I noticed that the cheek of each and every pony on the boxes of toys, I haven't checked whether it was on the cartoons, but it probably was, but on the boxes of toys, the cheeks of these ponies were very large and bulbous, and they had a little red area right in the center. It really made you, you know, subliminally see a breast. So they were all highly sexualized, and so are all these other toys that they're giving us. And when the advertising was deregulated so that children, it really focused on children. They say that children make 80 to 90% of the decisions about food, about, of course, about toys, about where people will go on a vacation. You know, they've taught the children to beg for this stuff. So to get the children interested, they used animals to sell products. It's called anthropomorphism. They had Tony the Tiger and many others, which I didn't write down here. But then it ends up being Joe Camel. That was one of the worst. That was designed to make children interested in cigarettes at a young age. And not only that, but it's the face of the camel, you know, cartoon camel, Joe Camel. Hope I don't get in trouble for this, but I'm sure a lot of people know about this. You look at it, and it definitely looks like a cock and balls. The jowls of the camel are the balls, and his nose is the phallus. And there it is, right on his face. And they didn't stop there. A lot of these cartoon characters do things like this. I believe they choose actors for this. They choose them. I believe, this is my opinion. I haven't looked it up enough. I haven't been able to find it when I do try to look it up. Do they deliberately, you know, choose actors whose faces look like part of a sex organ to get people's attention? I believe that they actually puff up people's cheeks to make them look like breasts or butts. That they choose actors with a long, weird nose and representative of a phallus. I'm not crazy to say these things. It's in your face. I'm sure they did that on purpose. It's called subliminal advertising. But it's worse than that. I believe that when they choose these things for all these shows, they're trying to make people dislike each other, trying to make people believe in children that people are ugly, people look weird, people remind you of what's between your legs. That's what they're into. And I'm going to say that. I'm going to say it out loud. And I really believe this. I've seen so much of it. So a bill to protect the kids was passed 328-7 in the Senate and unanimously in the House. And in 1988, Reagan vetoed it. Right before he left, that was one of his last acts, he vetoed the bill that would have protected the children from using cartoons to sell products and selling products on the show and basing every show on the products they're going to sell. You know, they would even take stuff off the shelves that was already on there when they had a new action figure or something so that people would buy the new one. So this bill was passed by the people, by the Senate and the House, and Reagan vetoed it, not protect the children. And then there was, in 1990, the Children's Television Act, and it limits ads to 12 minutes per half an hour. Yay! That's almost half the time. What good is that? Half the time that your kids are looking at cartoons, they'd be allowed to see these ads for all this weird stuff. So do I have any more notes here? I don't think so. I think that does it for the notes. Is there anything else on this one? I don't think so. I actually went through all the notes that I wrote. I read you the poem. And now I'm going to be on my own, just on my soapbox, doing what I do. We'll see how that goes. I didn't go through everything. I wasn't able to study some of the deregulation issues that happened with Reagan. I'm going to add to it. I'm going to write an article and read it to you guys at some point with everything in it. That's the best way to make sure you've got something. So here it is. It's almost 5 o'clock. We still have another hour. I have things I can read to you. I'm saying people are better than that. We deserve better. Not just Americans, but everyone all over the world. So much injustice, so much power in the wrong places. When people look back 100 years from now, what will they say about us? You know, what did these people do to stop this stuff? Did they do anything? Of course, they tried. They did a lot of things, but we haven't succeeded in stopping them from poisoning us with chemtrails, from mandating us to get vaccines, or we'll lose our job or our home or so many, our business. That's not right. There's something wrong here. I have to say, I don't buy a lot of the vaccine stuff. The corporations are making too much money putting everybody else out of business and making people so frightened. They're afraid to go to a family gathering. They're afraid to see their friends. That's not right. And I don't see sick people around me. I just don't. I'm sorry. I mean, you guys can hate me for saying this, some of them, but I feel very strongly that it's inflated. If these things are really true, they're doing more than they need to try to stop it. They're doing things that, you know, only help the ones that are doing all these things I was just talking about. So it's a dangerous thing. It's beautiful that we have a democracy. We need to keep it. We need to hold on to it. Thomas Jefferson said something like, if we let the combinations, he meant the business combinations, gain control, our children will be born in a place, they will be born slaves in the place that their forebears died to defend. He said that. I don't have the exact quote, but it is in my on my website. I'm working on my website. I'm trying to get it up there with all the new things I want to put in it. It's going to have tons of pictures of Haight Street and the street kids and the drum circle, and it's called peacedrums.org. And it's going to have many quotes of the founding fathers, of Native American chiefs and leaders, of women. It's got a ton of quotes, which are really cool. Because I'm sending it to my web builder, and I wanted to have each thing on a separate page so that he might have to scan them because of the icons. And so I filled in the extra spaces with tons of quotes. And my website is called peacedrums.org, and it's up now. You can look at it, the older version, but the new one's going to have a lot more stuff on it, including lots of pictures. And I didn't tell you who I am, which I'm supposed to do at the beginning of the show. My name is Joan Rivard, and I wrote a book that's on Amazon called Peace Drums, Jesus Was a Hippie. You can get that. It's not expensive. It's only $14.99, and it's 400 pages. And a lot of it is the stories of the street kids on Haight Street and what they believe in and what they go through and how wonderful they are. They really are very special people. The homeless youth that camp in the park and on the sidewalk, they're very special people. So, you know, you get an inside view of what they're like and what they're into. And also our effort to keep Haight and Ashbury as the hippie capital of the world and to hold on to that corner, Haight and Ashbury. They've chased so many away with cameras, with making panhandling and busking, you know, making music to make money. They make these things illegal. They bust people. And these guys leave. They leave because they're afraid their dog's going to get confiscated, or they're going to end up with a giant fine. And I told you this many times, and I'll probably say it on every show, I am so brokenhearted that they removed the logs that we used to sit on next to the pond in Golden Gate Park, Alvord Lake. It's a beautiful little pond. And there used to be, 30 people there probably most of the time, especially in the morning and evening, just talking and hanging out and making music and with their dogs and everything. And they're gone. They're gone permanently. I thought they would maybe come back, but, first, they put the cameras up. They put 5 cameras up around the lake. And they did it, allegedly, because one guy got stabbed there. A guy got hurt. There was a guy that actually got killed. It's kind of a complicated story. It turns out he came back 3 times after they told him to leave, and somebody hurt him. I don't know who it was. It wasn't anybody I know. And I think, how hard is that for them to send somebody out there to do that just so that they can go ahead and put up their cameras? The more crime they find, the more disturbance, that gives them the go-ahead to put up the cameras. And so they did. They put up 5 cameras, and from that day forward, nobody sat there. Nobody came. And the logs were still there, though. There used to be those logs all along the walkway next to the pond, and it was packed with people in this beautiful spiritual scene, that people travel from across the country to come and be part of. And from that day forward, nobody sat there. And so then that wasn't enough. And I've told you this before, if you heard it, but I'll say it over and over if I have to, because they took those logs away, those logs. They were worn smooth on top from people sitting on them. They were so comfortable. They were just the right height. There were logs all along the walkway, I don't know, a couple hundred feet, I think. And they were just right for us to sit on, and people would come with their dogs and everything. And that's where we would meet our friends in the morning and get coffee from the McDonald's across the street. You could get coffee for $1. And, it was a beautiful scene. That's what brought me to San Francisco. I think I've been here about 8 years. And when I saw that and the drum circle, I thought, this is for me. I've got to be here. And I'm here, and I'm not leaving. So they put up the cameras. They took away the logs. They then made sure nobody could sit there, even without the logs. These guys, they don't mind sitting on the ground if they have to. But no, they can't do that. They've got this black metal barricade with black metal posts that are phallic. They're tall and they're round on top, and they're painted black. And then there's chains in between each of the two of them. And if that wasn't enough, they put sharp rocks and big rocks, sharp boulders. Well, how can I say? They're about 1 foot across, maybe, each one. Some 2 feet across, and they're sharp. You can't sit on them. They made sure, the points were pointing up, so nobody would even try to sit behind this chain on these rocks. And what else did they do? They put this ugly pier into the small pond that was just perfect, just the way it was. And they put this big wooden pier there. There's no way you can sit on it. There's a barricade, there's a wooden edging on it that we try to sit on, but it's real uncomfortable. It's only about 1 inch wide. And if that wasn't enough, if you can try to sit on that or sit on the wooden pier itself, no, that's not going to happen either. There's hardly any room because they put these displays, these plexiglass boxes, cylinders with dirt in them that are supposed to tell you about the algae inside the pond. And, I don't care about the algae. There was important spiritual stuff going on around that pond. There was the hope of mankind. The stuff Jesus talked about was happening there. And they totally took that away from us. And what else are they taking away from us? What about these flower planters you see everywhere? These big barrels, real heavy, so you can't move them. And they have a few plants in them. And we know that they are put there so people won't camp there. So, I know, is it liability insurance? Is it because somebody's liable if somebody dies in their tent there on the sidewalk? I don't know, but they've made it nearly impossible, very difficult for people to camp, to live on the street, if they have to live on the street, if they have nowhere else. And I particularly hate this on Haight Street and in that area, because this isn't your ordinary homeless area. These people come here because they believe in something. They come here like a pilgrimage, and also to see their friends, which they consider family. You know, their street friends, their street brothers and sisters, the travelers. They travel around the country. The reason they go to these rock concerts is they want to see their friends. They say, "Are you going to be at such and such?" "Oh, yeah, yeah, I'll be there." You know, and that's how it is. It's not just, you know, they could live somewhere much easier, much warmer. Oftentimes, they go to places like New York in the wintertime to see their friends at a rock concert or something like that. So I don't like these big planters they're putting everywhere on the sidewalk. They are an insult. It's not so we can see pretty plants, and so they can keep people from camping there. So what was I going to say anymore about that? It breaks my heart that they're trying to kill the hippie dream with these things. And it doesn't stop there. You know, I think I've seen evidence of them actually sending people out to make trouble for us, to start fights, to steal backpacks, to even urinate on people while they're sleeping. There's nobody sleeping out there on that sidewalk there on Haight Street anymore. I think all of them have gotten tickets or something. They're just not there. It's sad to walk through at night. I used to walk through there at night, late at night, and feel perfectly safe because there were always lots of people there, good people, people that knew me, that I knew. We were family. I felt no fear whatsoever. And now you walk through and there's hardly anyone there. It's unbelievable how fast that happened. So I want those people to come back. I want that to come back. I want them to take those cameras down. I'm asking for that. I really am. I'm going to give speeches at the community meeting and maybe City Hall and places like that and say, we don't want them. We don't want these cameras. And of course, that's not enough to stop the cameras, but we need to start that conversation, and we need to have a plan to stop a totalitarian police state from taking over our lives, because Jesus said that we're all sons and daughters of the Most High, and we deserve to be free. When we're not free, things die. You know, they're killing the planet. They're killing everything. You look at the rainforest. I went to Hawaii. I expected to see jungles. No, no jungles. You know, there was one place where I saw it a little bit. You know, I didn't see, it just seemed like it was stripped of vegetation, a lot of it. It's just a lot of hotels, but no jungles. Just a few palm trees here and there, the tall, skinny kind. I don't know, man. I complain about a lot of things, and I may not always be perfectly accurate. I sing my heart song, and it's not the same as, you know, something where everything is carefully researched every time. I'm researching as much as I can, though, to see if I'm right. I could read you another poem. This one's about cameras. I wrote this a long time ago. It's going to be in the new book coming out, Peace Drums, The Drum Circle, Peace Drums 2. On my website, you're going to see a prompt for when I get the new one up. You're going to see something for the book I already have out, Peace Drums, Jesus Was a Hippie. You'll see a lot about that. The back pages will be on the home page, I mean the back cover of the book. But then it tells you the books that are coming out. And I'm publishing Peace Drums 3 before Peace Drums 2 because it's already written. But I wanted Peace Drums 2 to be, you know, after they're all published, the two will come right after the one. Peace Jumps 3 is about living in Alaska in the 70s, in 1969 and 70. Hippies living in Alaska in the woods in cabins and hovels and all kinds of things that they would make. And you could do that in those days. There weren't tons of liability laws. You know, if somebody had an empty shack or something, they'd let you camp there because they were not liable if you stubbed your toe or something. If they were, they weren't aware of it. It was, everything was much easier and cheaper, too. I lived for free in Alaska. After I moved out of the dormitory at the University of Alaska, I found a cabin. You could call it a cabin. I don't know if I told you this story. You know, these grandmothers, they tell stories over and over. They forget that they already told them. So bear with me. But I don't think everyone listens. Whoever's listening to this probably doesn't listen to it every time. And so it's not the end of the world to tell a story a second time. I can tell you this story. It would take up some time that I have like 40 minutes left that I have to come up with stuff. So I might as well tell you the story. It's quite interesting. I was living at the University of Alaska as a little college girl in the dormitory. I went to Alaska. I suddenly got a passion for Alaska. I read a library book and I thought, this is the place for me. And I went up there to go to college. That was the way I was going to get up there. But then when December came, I didn't have the money to pay for any more of the dormitory. So I was a full-time student. And so these hippie friends of mine that I met told me about a shack on Chena Pump Road that nobody was living in, and they thought that I should fix it up and move in. And I had absolutely no experience doing anything like this. And these people, they were so hardy, these hippie people that lived in their own cabins. They had built these cabins. I'm sure I told you this story. This guy had bought some land and told the hippies that he would provide logs and materials for them to build their own cabins on his land, and that they would live for free for a year, and afterwards they would pay a small rent. And so, yeah, they built about five of them, and it was a magical place. We called it the campground. I guess it started out being a campground. I think it actually was a village during the gold rush called Nenana. I think it was the town of Nenana previously. There were old foundations of cabins that you could find there. It was next to a pond right off the Nenana River. Was it the Nenana River or the Tanana? I think it was the Nenana. And so I had a place about halfway out to the campground. The campground was 5.5 miles from the university, and these folks would walk. They had no problem walking when it was 40 and 30 below, and they would just walk. They had the right clothes on, the right mukluks, the big shoes that you wear in a climate like this. And I learned from them. They brought me out to the campground. You know, I was a little college co-ed, and I was so impressed, you know, to see that there was no electricity there, no plumbing. You couldn't drive a car unless you heated it up with a fire under the engine. You had to build a fire with oil in a coffee can and set it under the engine. You had to bring in the battery in overnight so it wouldn't freeze. And then the wheels of the vehicle. There was one vehicle at the campground, and once in a while they would get all that going, and everybody would go at once, you know, to the store or wherever they needed to get stuff. And so, like for instance, water. I'm sure they had to carry some water out there, but you know, in the winter you could just melt snow. You really could, but I don't think they drank water out of that pond. I'm not sure about that. I didn't ask where they were getting their water. I think they used the truck and would just fill up a bunch of 5-gallon cans. And so I saw these people. They were living like that. And it was so sweet because they were hippies. You know, they were dressed like a hippie under the big parka with a big fur ruff and everything and the big mukluks. And it was magical. It was a magical place. So they told me, you should move into the black and silver cabin, this little shack. It wasn't even a cabin. It wasn't made out of logs. It had hollow walls, hollow wood frame walls. which made it impossible to live in the winter. But it had a good wood stove inside, and they thought that I could fix it up. Of course, I had no money. I was so young. I really thought you could do things with absolutely no money. And some of them did. And I had a little bit of food stamps I applied for in the end, and that was kind of enough for the month. I ate a lot at the university for free. There was a cafeteria there, and people would give you their leftovers. You had friends that would go for seconds, and you could go in there. You know, there were no big restrictions and security rules and locks and gates. You could just go right into the cafeteria, and even if you weren't a student, and hang out with your friends. I was a student, though, but I no longer had a meal ticket. And so I think a lot of my nutrition came from leftovers at the cafeteria. And, I got kicked out of the dorm for not having any money. And I spent a couple weeks staying with other people. Sorry. Hang on a second. Sorry about that. It seemed like an impossible task to fix that cabin. I had nothing to put in the walls for insulation. The story was I thought that I was so young, so naive. I don't know if they told me what they were telling me how I should do this, but I came up with the thought that I could put sawdust in the walls and just get it for free from lumber yards and, of course, hope that somebody with a truck would bring it to my place and drill holes on the tops of the, you know, where the empty spaces are inside the wall and just pour it into those spaces. Well, that wasn't a very good plan. It would never have worked. And I worked on this cabin. I don't know. I cleaned it up. I tried I started to tear the stuff off the walls. I guess I did. I wasn't going to tear it all off to put the sawdust. Anyway, I was working on it. I think I just cleaned it up and was kind of hanging out there. And I was crashing, what you'd call crashing, at a friend's across the road from there. There was somebody about an eighth of a mile away and in a cabin. And they had a good wood stove and everything. And I was sleeping on the floor there for a little while. And so then, I'm sure I told you the story. I hope you don't mind me telling it again. One day I went there, and it was jam-packed with pink fiberglass insulation, giant bales of it. Like, it was so packed, you could barely close the door. The outhouse was also packed with these bales of pink insulation. And I thought somebody was trying to move in instead of me. And I thought, my God, I'd better get over here. I had been offered places to live for free by two different couples that came. One person was a janitor at the university, and he invited me to his family's home and told me I could stay in their spare bedroom for free. And I tried it, but I was miserable. For one thing, his schedule was different from mine. I had to go home with him at the end of the day and not stay and hang around at the Houston Union buildings. You know, I didn't have a chance to be with these new friends of mine. It was very restricted. And I didn't want to go there by myself because it was far. It wasn't that close. And you had to hitchhike. And I had a bad experience one time hitchhiking. Not real bad, but a guy scared me. And I got out of the truck and I ran away. And he doubled back, but then he left. And so then I'm not going to hitchhike on that highway anymore. You know, I from then on, when I lived at the Black and Silver, I think that I walked the short distance from the university to China Pump Road, so I would not have to hitchhike on that road. And I would then hitchhike, if I could, on China Pump Road. But if you weren't at the right time, nobody would come by. You had to hit it right when the professors were going up. They had houses on what we called China Ridge. They had nice houses with electricity and everything. But that was not on China Pump Road. It was the road you get to from China Pump Road. But I could catch a ride with them. Sometimes in the morning, that was good if you went there at the right time when they were going to work. Anyway, I decided not to live with these people as comfortable and as nice as it was. And they had tons of canned salmon and canned caribou. I was eating like a queen. But I felt sad that I had missed the opportunity for this great adventure to move into this place, you know, in the forest. It was in the forest, even though it was right on the road. It had forests all around it and across the road and a river running right behind it. And I decided, you know, that's what I went up there for. And so I went to the cabin, like I said, and there was this pink fiberglass insulation. I decided I better get myself over here or somebody else is going to move in. But then I found out my friends had found it and given it to me. They had found a big pile of it under a snowbank near the university, and they decided it was being thrown away, and they put it in their truck and took it to my cabin. And so then I was trying to remove the inside walls of the cabin. I call it a cabin. It was not a log cabin. It's called the Black and Silver Cabin because the outside of it was this black asbestos-looking material. I still wonder what that stuff was made out of, because the inside walls, I pulled them off, you know, and they made dust, and I breathed it plenty, and hey, it didn't affect me as far as I know. I don't know what it was made out of. It was about an inch thick, like really thick cardboard, but a little harder. And the inside walls were white inside, and the outside walls, all the stuff was made out of something that was black. And the roof was made out of corrugated tin, so that's why they called it the Black and Silver Cabin. And you can see a picture of it on my website. I think it's on one of the stories about Alaska. There's one of the prompts that says Alaska, and there's about three chapters about those people living there. It's not about me, but it's about people that lived at the campground and other places in the area. And it was kind of a losing battle, me trying to do this by myself. I was using a claw hammer to pull the stuff off the walls, and I had giant mittens on, and you could only stay out there for about, I don't know, 20 minutes, because it wasn't like walking where you're moving constantly, and I would get cold pretty rapidly in about a half an hour, and then I'd have to go across the street to this other cabin and get all warmed up and warm up your clothes. You warm your clothes, and then you put your clothes on that they've been, you know, not all your clothes, but your parka. You hold your parka next to the stove until it's nice and hot, and then you put it on, and that keeps you warm a little bit longer. And I would then run back across the road and work on it. But then one day, I'm sure I told you this story. I have to look at the archives to see what I've already talked about. I have to take notes. I'm sorry, I don't remember stuff very well, and I'm used to telling the same stories over and over because I meet the public, and, you know, I just talk about whatever comes into my head, and mostly it's people that haven't heard it before. And so the three of my friends walked up to help me. All of a sudden, I see these three people, and we call them sourdoughs because they were experienced Alaska people. They didn't come from Alaska. They some of them might have been their first winter. Some of the people at the campground, it was their first winter, and they did all this. These people, though, I don't think it was their first winter, these three. They really knew what they were doing. There was Susanna Risley, who lived at the campground in one of the cabins. She had not built it, but she was running something that was almost like a store, except the stuff was free. She had extra cans of dog food and toilet paper and canned goods and stuff in case people needed it. And she had a really nice cabin, though. Hers was the biggest. It was the oldest. I think it was built on the foundation of one of the cabins from 100 years before. And I can't believe it. I think it actually had a basement. I remember a stairway going down where she had these things were stored. She had a really nice wood stove that you could cook with, and also another wood stove that was a Franklin stove. And she had invited me to go and stay with her a couple times so I could learn the ropes. She's the one who taught me how to live in a place like that, how to get the frozen water out of the barrel of frozen water that was inside her house, how to build a fire, you know, and what you do. And everything, and she helped me a lot. So here comes Susanna and Becky and this other man that was from Russia. Becky was a woman, a young woman, who had built her own, you could call it a cabin. We called these things cabins, but they weren't what you would think of as a log cabin. She was really strong. She had built herself a place really in the wilderness, like, you know, a mile or two from the university. It was next to Smith Lake. I saw it one time when these friends and I skied, cross-country skied to Chena Ridge, actually, for a sauna, and we stopped at her cabin and had a meal. And it was amazing, this thing that she had built. And she dug walls out of the dirt. She dug out a hill on one side where there was three walls, and an open area in the front. And then she dragged herself, by herself, plywood into the woods and materials and old windows, and she made a cabin out of it. And I sat in there and had a nice meal. There was only room for a bed and a wood stove, and then everything else goes under the bed. I think I told you about another one like that. That was a common way to live. In fact, I'm sure the pilgrims and people like that had huts like this, not these fancy places you see in the movies. They probably built something like that when they first got there. So it was a dugout. This was what you'd call a dugout. But the front of it was built, and the roof, and there were walls attached to the wooden, the dirt sides of it. So she came, and this other guy that was from Russia, he had a cabin that he had built in the woods, and his was really nice. He knew what he was doing. He built it with real lumber from the lumber yard, and it was pretty cool. He was famous for not lighting a fire in his cabin. He liked the cold. He went long times without lighting a fire, and I don't know how he did that. So they all came, and they helped me, and they tore the walls off the inside so fast. The first thing they did was use plastic to close off the two windows that were in the place. And they cleaned the wood stove. It was full of trash. And they cleaned that out, and they lit a fire. And we lit the kerosene lamps that I had bought at the hardware store. There was two of them. And there were two of them. And we went to work. And in just a few hours, they transformed that place so much that I was able to spend the night there. They tore off the inside walls. My job was to sweep up all the debris, and they put the insulation in with staple guns, and then we unrolled this giant piece of plastic that I had bought, this roll of plastic sheeting, and we covered all the walls with it. Did we put it on the ceiling? I don't remember putting any on the ceiling. The ceiling was not insulated, come to think of it. So in the cabin, it had a peaked roof. There was a loft up above it. There were two lofts, actually. It was a peaked roof, you know, just like a V, an upside-down V. And on each side was a large shelf, big enough to walk on, not tall enough. The middle of that section you could stand up in, but the sides, not so much. And that was going to be the sleeping area. And there was a wall in between the two sections where the peak of the cabin was. A wall went down to the ceiling, and it made like two little bedrooms up there. So we sealed off one half, because every little bit counts in a place like that. You don't want the heat going up in there if nobody's up there. And so we sealed off one side with the plastic, and the other side became my sleeping area. And they fixed it all, and I was able to sleep there the same night. This is going to be embarrassing if I said every detail of this a couple weeks ago. But, you know, I'm not afraid. I love you guys. You know, I'm used to meeting lots of people, and I haven't had any real bad experiences doing that. People are wonderful. They are kind. They are sweet. And this is an interesting story. You know, if grandma tells, I don't want to be called grandma, by the way. I prefer, you know, elder or something like that. I'm not ready to be called grandma by the world at large. My hair is not white yet, even though I'm 73. And I dance like crazy at the drum circle every weekend. So I don't consider myself to be washed up in any way. What happened? I slept there that night. And in the morning, I didn't know how to build a fire because I didn't have anything real good to build it with. I had used the armload of wood that I got from across the street, a donation from the person I had been staying with. And that had been used up throughout the night. I couldn't build a fire. I couldn't start a fire with the stuff that we had pulled off the walls, because it would burn fine if there was a fire going. But then once you couldn't start a fire with it. And I went out and got branches and twigs and tried that. And I worked on it for about an hour. And meanwhile, I slept in my parka. I slept in all my gear and just army sleeping bags with feathers in them. Somebody had loaned me two army sleeping bags, one inside the other. And I did get a little bit cold, but not anything dangerous. And I knew that, I could go across the street and go to that other cabin if I needed to. It wasn't dangerous, but it was a little discouraging. And finally, I gave up and I went out and I stuck my thumb out and somebody picked me up. And they looked at me weird because it turns out my face was covered with soot and I wasn't aware of it from trying to build that fire. And they took me to the university where I took, several baths and washed these clothes, several times in the washing machine there trying to get, I had worked with the insulation after the people left. I had attempted to insulate the my sleeping area, the attic, the shelf on one side that was where I would sleep. The shelf was open all across one side of the cabin, and particularly where the stove was. So the stove would heat that place up real nice. You'd go up there, and it was too hot at first. You had to sleep without any blankets. But then very soon, as soon as the fire went down, it would get cold, and then you'd have to bundle up. So I had tried to insulate the roof of this area with the fiberglass insulation, and they may have told me that you're not supposed to touch it and breathe it, but I guess I forgot. I didn't care. I didn't know what would happen. And so the next morning, I was completely covered with itchy, scratchy, tiny glass particles from the fiberglass that had fallen all over me while I was trying to insulate the ceiling of this loft. So that's why I had to go and wash my clothes many times and, take a bath. And I don't know if I took several baths, I forget, but you could go in there. You could sneak in there. My old dorm, they didn't even know I wasn't living there anymore, and I could go in there and use the facilities, which I did the whole time I lived there. I didn't have to take a bath in the cabin or wash my clothes or anything. I could do that at the university. The university was very useful. You could go there and spend all day, in the warm student union building or the library. It was major luxury. And then you would go home. And I was a full-time student. I had classes, I think, about at least 3 days a week, maybe four. And I had to go every day. Well, that first time, I stayed at the university for several days. I didn't want to go back right away. I wasn't ready. And I didn't have any wood to burn. That was part of it. And so I made friends with somebody at the lumber yard and asked them if they had spare wood, and they did. They had big piles of it, old wood that, they weren't going to sell. So the man put them in his truck and brought them to my cabin with me and unloaded them. And he got stuck in my driveway in the snow, but he got out. And him and his wife showed up a few days later, maybe a week or two later, I don't know, and invited me to live at their house also. That was the second group of people that invited me because they thought, oh, this young girl by herself out there. But I wanted to stay. By that time, I wanted this. So I stayed there. Oh, I went back after about, a week or less. I went back there. I got the wood. And then a friend of mine told me that he knew where there was where there were lots of logs that I could use for firewood, and he borrowed his father's truck, and we went out there and loaded the back of the truck with wood from where they had built a road, and there was lots of logs. So those were brought to my home. I'm sure I told this story a couple weeks ago in great detail, just like now. Sorry, forgive me. It's using up the time, though. I only have 25 minutes left to come up with stuff. Hey, when Rachel gets here, though, I'll be able to play the music I like, and we'll be bouncing off Rachel, and we'll have guests, and we might be able to have some drummers over again. I would like to have musicians come and guests and everything. This is just still a work in progress. I'm out of my comfort zone. I'm getting less and less uncomfortable, though. I really am. I have more confidence now that I can do this. I can talk for 2 hours by myself. So I hope you don't mind. Anyway, so what happened next? Well, I got a cat. One time driving on a hitchhiking to the university, everybody used to hitchhike in those days. It wasn't a big deal. And this woman had a little cat in a box in her back seat, and she said she found her on the road, abandoned and half frozen, and her, there was something wrong with one of her legs. And I don't know, I fell in love with her, and I adopted her. I took the cat with the box. I took her to all my classes, carrying her in the box. And then I stayed with someone that was, you know, in town. I didn't go back to the cabin immediately. But eventually I did. And me and the cat lived there, and I stayed there from then on because I had to go home to take care of the cat. And, of course, everything would freeze every day when you left the house. And also at night when you were sleeping, everything in the cabin would be frozen, like right next to my head. The glass of water that I had there would freeze. But that was okay. You know, the cat was okay. She would go up and stay inside the two feather sleeping bags, and she was fine. But I had to come home, you know. So that was good. I had my little friend there, and I slowly made the cabin better. I made the weirdest looking floor you've ever seen. I wanted to insulate the floor. That was the coldest thing, where cold could come right up from the ground. And so I took all these mismatched pieces of wood, and I think I put down insulation and plastic on the floor, and then I just nailed the wood right over it in all different levels, all different sizes. It was really an unusual floor. I wonder if it's still there. I wonder if the cabin is still there. I would love to go see. Me and my ex-husband tried to look it up one time to see if the cabin was there, and we couldn't tell. The campground was completely gone, though. That was weird. We looked it up a couple years ago, and that campground was gone. All those cabins, I don't know what happened to them. Even the pond and the lay of the river had shifted a little bit since that time. So, you know, it lives on in my writing. That's Peace Drums 3, the Black and Two Stories of Alaska from the Black and Silver Cabin. That is coming out very soon. It's all written. It's been written for years. And all I have to do is format it for Amazon. And I'm going to do that as soon as I get finished with my putting up my website again. And that's what's been holding things up. I've felt that I had to finish that before I do anything else, which is ridiculous, but that's how I do things. And I'm also going to publish the Liberals Bible Guide, God's Message to Tree Huggers, which is an amazing 480-page reference book showing people exactly what scriptures tell us what Jesus really said and what scriptures tell us what other guys said, all of them, any of them, way different from everything he said. So that's coming out. And some of that is going to be on my new website also. And there is already some on it, if you want to look, peacedrums.org. It's got a section with some of that on it, but the next stuff is going to have way more. What else did I do? I took cardboard boxes and nailed them to the wall as an extra layer and to make it look more like a regular wall, because I put the plain side facing out, so it all was beige. And I built myself a bench. It was very weird. And I had a table that was a spool, a big spool for big electrical wire. You know, those big wooden spools. I don't know if you've ever seen one around here. We used to have them all the time. Everybody had a table made out of that in Alaska, in those cabins. And a neighbor loaned me a tablecloth and an axe, and I had a hatchet. And I got my neighbor across the street where I had been staying to come and cut my wood for me with his chainsaw in exchange for the electric blanket that I owned that I couldn't use because I had no electricity. So I gave him that, and he cut up all my firewood. And then the pièce de résistance that made it easier for me to build fires was when I found this old wooden gate across the road lying there, abandoned, you know. It was a little bit off the road. And I dragged it to my cabin, and it was perfect for kindling. It was all dry, old gray wood, and there was quite a lot of it. And I cut that stuff up into kindling and made it so I would be all ready to start a fire at any time. And in just minutes, I could run down from the loft when it was freezing cold, and I mean freezing, like I told you, you know, 5 gallons of water frozen next to your head. And well, maybe that part was downstairs. And upstairs, I just had a glass of water. I put a cat box upstairs and downstairs so that my cat, it could climb up the ladder to the loft, but it could not climb down because of its messed up leg. And so I fixed it so she had everything she needed up there or down below. And when you wanted to use the water, you had to put the 5 gallon metal container on top of the stove to melt the water, melt a little bit of the water so you could pour some out. And you had to prepare the night before what you were going to use the next day. It might take a while for that stuff to melt. You had to, I guess I must have had it on the stove the whole time I was in there. You melt enough of it to pour into a wash basin to wash your face and a coffee cup and maybe a glass of water. And I would use those. Like in the morning, you'd put the metal wash basin on the stove so it would melt, and then you could wash your face in it. And the same with the coffee cup and everything else like that. So it was quite an adventure. It was wonderful. I wrote a lot about it in that book that's coming out, Peace Drums 3, True Stories of Alaska from the Black and Silver Cabin. And I'm putting that up on my website. I'm publishing that and the Bible Guide before I publish Peace Drums 2. Because Peace Drums 2, the drum circle, it needs a lot of work still. I wrote most of it before I wrote Peace Drums 1 about the street kids. Jesus was a hippie. But when I started writing about the street kids, people said that it was much better than what I had written previously. And so I just went ahead and finished that one and published it. And so now I'm going back and using what I already wrote in Peace Drums 2. But I have a lot of work because I have a lot of notes that I've taken out on in the field, and I've got to go through those notes and organize them and write lots of new articles, and there's quite a lot of work involved in finishing that book. And that's why Peace Drums 3 is going to be up there and published before Peace Drums 2. But I don't think you guys will mind. They're all interesting, and especially the Bible Guide. I'm very excited about that. It's humorous, it's entertaining. Almost all of it is in Elizabethan English, straight out of the King James Bible. It's the scriptures rearranged big time. So you can see everything Jesus said about this, everything he said about that, and then you see what Paul added, you know, specifically about each topic. I read you some of it a week or two ago, what he said about women being no good and women, you know, gave Adam the fruit, and so therefore they are responsible for the fall of mankind, and that's all in there, and you can see exactly where it came from. It's really neat. I think that people who read that book, even read the table of contents, will know more than most preachers. The preachers don't tell you these things. They don't tell you some of the wonderful things it says in there Jesus said. And it also breaks down exactly, you know, which parts of the New Testament most theologians believe were added, that were they were not written by the person that they are attributed to. And then I talk about poisonous scriptures, things that were obviously added to give power to kings, emperors, whoever you want, nobles, priests, popes. Those things were not said by Jesus, and I can show you why, how, and who added them and why. So it's a very dynamic book. And so that's the story of Alaska. What else did I want to tell you about that? I can't think of anything else right now. Boy, it's so cold in here. I'm colder here than I was in Alaska, seriously. Because in Alaska, you don't fool around. You know, you've got warm clothes, really warm clothes, and not heavy necessarily. I mean, down feathers are the best thing. Any feathers, but mostly down feathers. I had a down feather parka, and it did. It kept you from freezing. It kept your core body warm. And the first things that would start to freeze if you were walking far were the front of your thighs and your cheekbones. And I guess that was it. Most of those were the things. That's how you could tell. And as you were walking, you'd breathe, and all this frost would land on your scarf and your hat, your ruff and everything. That's why I had Wolverine around my ruff, because they say it doesn't freeze. I'm sure I told you guys all this already. Oh, well, that's all right. Maybe some of you weren't listening at that time. So it's fun to tell this story. And we're almost going to be done here. We've got about 14 more minutes. Let me read you a poem that I wrote. I call these things poems. They don't rhyme, but they have a certain cadence, and they're put together in 8 lines with every other line indented, and each one has kind of focuses on an issue. So this one is called The Eye. Hold on a second. Sorry. The eye. It clicks your picture if you roll through stop signs, but that's not all that it can do. With biometrics, it could recognize, potentially, every person on Earth. I forgot about scanning driver's licenses and things like that. They've gone beyond that now. They don't need biometrics. They can know who you are just by picking up on what's on your driver's license and other things. With biometrics, it could recognize potentially every person on Earth. Our body shapes are like a fingerprint that cameras can pick up. Added to this, computer info can tell everything we've ever done, from health and work records to what we buy with grocery discount cards. Software and the devices on our cars and phones can track our every move from outer space. Camera sellers and their lobbyists want to install in alleys cameras that shout at you to make sure no one dumps a bag of trash or an old couch. It yells with a loud voice when an illegal act is seen, startling people out of their wits. It warns suspects to get away, but films them and their license plate so they can later confiscate their car or charge them with a crime. The victims of this scam, always the poor, have a much better chance where muggers roam the streets. The people see it on the news and they whisper among themselves. They are afraid the thing might hear inside their homes. And what about Alexa? What's it doing? You know, are they listening to us with our computers? We don't know for sure. This stuff was written a long time ago. You know, it's true, but they have more advanced things now. What if it sees into their yards, adjacent to where alleys are? What about those killer drones we hear about? They approved those in San Francisco just recently. What if it gets a new technology that sees through walls? Behind what walls they find, the people talk about the change. A year ago, they never feared to walk outside like they do now. Since time began, we could find privacy in wilderness or in our homes. But this is being thrown away so camera makers can make bucks. Now we'll have even more reason to stay inside, unseen. Or is it true computers look at you, not only you at them? Folks exchange rumors and half-truths, confused as to which are real news items and which are not. Between saving the children and insurance law, there's not one inch of earth that shouldn't be beneath the camera's gaze. That's surely what Spy Cams or Us believes, and several thousand well-paid lobbyists do too. Even in bathrooms, we don't know if high-tech moralists might spy to save the kids from pervs. At work, of course, the monitoring is just routine to make sure we don't tell a joke or sneak a smoke. It is a mandate of the insurers who want to record everything in case sexual harassment suits are filed. Recordings are not there to see if anyone gets hurt, but to help underwriters wiggle out of any claims. For this, we have to live in goldfish bowls, an easy prey for corporate predators trying to lock us up. We know it's not the violent criminals they want, but normal people doing normal things. It's so much easier to prove a urine test than to solve violent crimes, with spy cameras to catch smokers and drinkers in their yards. The prison builders and surveillance sellers go together to the bank, while people learn to stay indoors, away from the gaze of the eye. I wrote this, God, I don't know, 20 years ago? And I've got on it, Let's Take One Step Together, Potluck with Neighbors the first Saturday of each month, Play Drums for Half an Hour at Sunset on Saturdays. I've added to this, Yell Out the Window, we love you too. That's what we do at the Rainbow Gathering, and we yell it for like a half an hour. It's really cool. I think I already told you guys this right at this show. But this is what I write, this kind of stuff. I've got another one here about prisons. Prison industry, making money, locking people up, making money, making young people look like criminals. That's what I was writing about here. They've turned young people into criminals. Turned love into sex. They sexualize everything. And not just telling us about it, but, you know, subliminal sex organs in people's faces and in all the advertisements. I've seen some that are so obvious. I mean, they're not just obvious. They are in your face. I mean, there's a big butt right in your face that's supposed to be a woman's arm and her chest, but it looks like a butt. And you know, it looks like her legs are spread open. And her head is real tiny. It looks like a child's head also. It's very innocent looking. I need to get a picture of that so I can show people that it's really true. What am I hearing? Must be somebody outside walking by. Well, here's one about prisons. Cages. 1,000-year prison sentences with 10 life terms. Do they have 1,000-year ones? Not really, but they have, you know, 300-year prison sentences. And 20-year probations and million-dollar bails. Hair and saliva drug testing. Cameras that know who you are. Wait to entrap the inadvertent who don't even know they broke the law. They are the most easy to catch and the least able to defend, as they commit under the camera's gaze things normal people do, or that were not a crime a year ago, or that have never been a crime since time began. People who wouldn't hurt a fly are just as valuable in prison gold as dangerous felons whose capture might involve risk. Wow, this is a long one. Are those guilty of violent crimes who might get off and sue the state? They can sue the state for wrongful conviction if they can prove, You know, even if it's as obvious as can be that they committed the crime, if there was some mistake in the court proceeding or something, they can get out of it and sue the state. Whose conviction could be overturned by technicality. Drug crimes are so easy to prove, or statutory crimes in which the letter of the law not only kills but bludgeons liberty. Folks get life sentences for merely being where there was a crime or for an accident they didn't intend. To spy on people in their privacy, the corporations have devised smart dust, tiny machines smaller than coins that look like bugs. They are designed to fly or crawl upon demand. They have computers, sensors, and radios to report all. So who needs horror flicks when surveillance cellars make the laws? Supermax cages yawn to get us all and drive us mad with mind control. Will we be inmates screaming and throwing feces at the wall? Could cops break down our door because some neighbor told a lie? Weird legal terms that entrap the innocent. That doesn't belong there. Weird legal terms entrap the innocent, like implied malice or impaired consent. Impaired consent. You had sex with your wife, you know, 20 years ago, and you guys drank alcohol. That's impaired consent. It's called rape. They will say that was a rape. Unbelievable. Implied malice means you didn't really have any real malice. It's just implied. How about indirect criminal contempt or risk of injury? The person did get injured, but there was a risk that they could be injured. So that's a crime. Have turned to felons, normal people doing their best. Huge punishments are handed out, mostly to poor, for things that didn't hurt anyone or things that others did. We're put in cages for our life for accidents that couldn't be helped, so insurers can shift the blame and not pay claims. If they can say it's a crime, they don't have to pay. Backbreaking fines the Bill of Rights strictly forbade enslave the poor, but not the rich, find a much smaller portion of their goods. To pay a fine, parents give up school clothes for kids and Christmas too. In this harsh race, you can lose everything for one wrong move. Cities get tough on peeing in public, sleeping on library steps. Without public toilets or shelters, homeless are inmates in a flash. As lobbyists haggle to enrich the builders of cameras and jails, our liberty is bought and sold. Orwellian horrors that would make the founders run have become part of daily life. In the weird maze of lonely rooms where employees rest between jobs, then go outside again and shuffle on beneath the camera's gaze. We have no time for family life, or to read books or make a friend. The tripled price of everything makes sure we don't look right or left. We don't have time to cook and so submit to poison and fast food. No time to marry, so instead we adopt pets. They don't let us do that anymore either. Most places you can't have a pet. The cry of brotherhood is seldom heard unless you count the sound of the same sports from everywhere. They feel like brothers when they're looking at sports, but, you know, that's not enough. Instead of smiling at each other, we've been taught to look away. Turn the page. Sorry. Almost done with this one. We've been taught to look away in case our neighbor is a psycho killer or a pervert of some sort. So then we sit between four walls and wonder why we feel alone. The advertisers fill the gap with poisonous goods and thoughts. Each pillow is wet with its separate tears in each small cell, not different really from the cages in some prison blocks nearby. I'm saying they're imprisoning us with all this stuff, with all these talk about regulations. Boy, we got millions of regulations against normal people, nothing against corporations and all their horrible power. So, yeah, that's it. We're about done here. It's 6:02. I get to go someplace now where it's warm and eat food, and, you know, it's nice. It's sometimes a challenge to come here because sometimes I'm not sure what I'm going to talk about and if I'm strong enough to do all this, but it's worked out good so far. And I apologize if I told the same story a second time. I still think it's interesting enough to warrant hearing it a second time. But I need to look at the archives and see which things I've read already and which stories I've already told. And well, we love you. I love you. And I don't know who you are, but I know that all the people I've met in all these years, you know, greeting the public, you know, hundreds of people, maybe thousands I've met by this time, working the swap meets and hanging out on Haight Street and the drum circle. And I love every one of them. I really do. Even people that are not that cool sometimes, they have their good side. You know, you just have to give them a chance. I believe in mankind. I do not believe mankind is born evil and there's something wrong with him. I don't believe that. I haven't seen a lot of evidence of it. I don't want to challenge that, yeah, but the thing is, I love the people. They're beautiful. They want to love. They want to be free. They want us, other people, to be free. Almost everybody you meet will express that. So,